Hello, and welcome to the Text in Us podcast. I'm your host, George Fricks, and I'm here with my co-host, L. Grover Fricks, to resume our discussion in Esther chapter 2.
Let's see what these folks are up to in this scroll. So many folks, so little time.
And only one discussion.
All right, here we go. This is the word of the Lord. After these things, as the hot, poisonous anger of the king Ahasuerus was soothed, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been cut over her. The young men of the king who attended to him said, "Let them seek out young women still separated from society, good and for looking at, on behalf of the king. The king will appoint managers in all provinces of his kingdom. They will gather together all the young women who were still separate from society, good and for looking at, to the fortress of Shushan, to the house of the women, for the hand of Hige, whose name meant whispering fire, eunuch of the king, guardian of the women. They will be gifted to him for their scouring and polishing. The young woman is good in the eyes of the king. Make her queen under Vashti." This thing was good in the eyes of the king. He did so. A man of Yehuda was in the fortress of Shushan. His name was Mordechai, which means Marduk, or calf of the sun. He was the son of Yair, he enlightens, son of Shimi, heated, son of Kish, snare setter, a man of Yamini, or Benjamin, son of my right hand. He had been stripped from Yerushalayim, flowing peace with the stripped ones who had been stripped with Yechoniah, God will make firm, king of Yehuda, who was stripped by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, whose name means in Babylonian, God of wisdom, watch over my heir. Hadassah, myrtle tree, who was Esther, was entrusted. She was the daughter of his uncle, for she had no father or mother. The young woman was beautiful in her lines and good for looking at. When her father and her mother died, Mordechai took her for himself for a daughter. It was when the word of the king and the decree was heeded that a great many young women were gathered toward the fortress of Shushan into the hand of Hege. Esther was taken to the house of the king toward the hand of Hege, the guardian of the women. The young woman was good in his eyes. She bore up his compassion before his face. He trembled to hurry her scouring and polishing, and with her portion he gave her 7 young women to see to her, gifted from the house of the king. He folded her and her young women to the good place in the house of the women. Esther had not declared her people or her place of birth, for Mordechai commanded over her that she not declare it. All day and every day, Mordechai walked himself before the face of the court and the house of the women to learn of Esther's peace and what was being done in her. When each young woman's turn struck to enter toward the king Ahasuerus at the end of her regulations of the women, 12 months, for so the days were filled with scouring and polishing, 6 months in oil of myrrh, and 6 months in balsam for scouring and polishing the women. In this, each young woman came to the king, and all she uttered she was gifted to bring with her from the house of the women until the house of the king. In the dusk she went, and in the morning she returned to the house of the women, second to the hand of Shaaskaz, servant of the beautiful, eunuch of the king, who guarded the concubines. She would not come back to the king unless he delighted in her, as the king called for her by name. When the turn struck for Esther, daughter of Avichail, my father is force and valor, uncle of Mordechai, who had taken her to be his daughter to come before the king, she sought nothing but what Haggai, eunuch of the king, guardian of the women, said. Esther bore up patronage in the eyes of all who looked at her. Esther was taken to the king Ahasuerus to his royal house in the 10th month, that is the month of Tevet, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women. She bore up patronage and compassion before his face more than all the separated women. He placed his royal crown in her head and made her queen under Vashti. The king made a great drinking party for all his commanders and his servants, the drinking party of Esther and a day of rest in the provinces that he made. He gave lifted things according to the hand of the king. The separated women were gathered together a second time, and Mordechai sat in the gate of the king. Esther had not declared her place of birth and her people as Mordechai had commanded over her, for Esther did the utterance of Mordechai as when she was in his trust. In those days, Mordechai sat in the gate of the king, Bigdan, which means in the wine press, and Teresh, austere, two of the eunuchs of the king and guardians of the threshold, broke into a rage. They sought to send a hand in the king Achashverosh. The thing became known to Mordechai. He declared it to Esther, the queen. Esther said it to the king in the name of Mordechai. The thing was sought out. It was found. The two of them were hung upon a tree. It was written in the scroll of the words of the days before the face of the king. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
What a doozy. We've got drama. We've got a year at Sephora.
Right. Yep.
We've got all the fun elements in today's chapter. We've got surprise hangings. You know, what more could you ask for from a good narrative?
Yeah, it's fully loaded.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. Okay, well, let's get into it so we can start to talk about some of those things. I've split this into two portions for us. I've got verses 1 through 14 as our first portion, and verses 15 through the end as our second, just to kind of give us a little bit more
structure
to work with here. So let's get into our first part. Verse 1, after these things, as the hot, poisonous anger of the king Achashverosh was soothed, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been cut over her. That's a great opening line for this chapter. There are a lot of interesting things in here that stood out to me.
Okay.
One is just, you know, hot, poisonous anger is just this interesting image, right? Because it really keys in on the negative aspect that anger can have if you're like, you know, this is kind of like almost into bitterness,
yeah,
right? The anger is poisoning the person, so to speak.
Right.
So it's a fascinating imagery to utilize for this.
Yeah. Right? I think the text throughout has a pattern of talking about people who are evil, are people who are loud and keep breaking things, and people who are angry are experiencing something which the text frames as dangerous, mm-hmm, and uncomfortable for the person. And here in both Arabic and Assyrian, Akkadian, that is, it is the word for poison.
Yeah.
So you could really translate it as the hot poison of the king abated.
Right.
But thought that might be a little bit confusing coming ex nihilo. If it's
right.
been a while
sure.
since you listened to the lot, it's like, who did he poison? What happened?
Sure.
Yeah. It shows up for the first time in Genesis 27, talking about the fury of the brothers.
Right. Jacob and Esau.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Right. Also not a good anger. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to point out that good anger is few and far between.
Yeah.
And sometimes in Christian culture, we're like, God is angry at the wicked every day. So are we.
Right. Well, and okay. It's, you know, I mean, it's interesting that we see this in both applications, right? Because the concern in the Jacob and Esau story, right, is that Jacob is going to kill Esau.
Right.
Or the other way around.
Yeah, right. I heard the keywords. It checked out.
Yeah, yeah. Esau is going to kill Jacob, and Jacob runs away. Here, the king is angry. And if you go with the rabbinic commentary, does kill his wife.
Oh, yeah. Beheaded in the backyard.
Yep, which is interesting. And then we move into... after it was soothed, he remembered Vashti.
Vashti, yeah.
Right?
It totally reminds me of God, by the way. Like, I'm not saying that Achashverosh is a great metaphor for God or anything, but It reminds me of different phrases we've seen about like, and then God remembered Noah.
Right. Oh, I think this is definitely, you could go there, not just because God remembered Noah, right? It's that same word for remembered, but it's also the same word for soothed, right?
Mm-hmm.
God remembered Noah, and so he sent his spirit to cross over the land, and the waters were soothed.
Right.
So both of these words in the same verse show up here. And I think you could draw some comparisons of, you know, they're painting this picture of Ahasuerus, who is this, maybe not literally in their culture, but at least in this story, right? He is the God figure, where otherwise God is absent from this book. And it's not a compassionate God figure.
No.
Right? It's a vengeful, power gone awry.
Yes.
God figure.
Very easy to manipulate, foolish,
right.
Drunk.
Right.
Drunk version. Yeah. I'm trying to think what a good drash is from that in the Pardes hermeneutic. If that's the remez, what would the drash be? Other than, aren't you glad God isn't like this? But in that situation, what's come right before it is this dualistic battle, right? So maybe you can frame Vashti and her husband facing off.
Sure.
As a dualistic battle. And then, well, I don't know if that pans out, because then he remembers her like she's Noah on the boat. So I don't know. Maybe they're saying something about alcohol, because alcohol continues to be a theme throughout this whole scroll. So maybe the alcohol is the flood, right? If they're having as much as they can possibly have in the previous one, no restraint is the rule. You know, so if you walk in, you're like, no, man, I only have a glass an hour or whatever. They're like, no restraint. That's the law. So maybe it's the flood of leisurely partying too much is the dualistic battle there. And then out of that fight with a substance use, he remembers Vashti, who is kind of floating in the ark.
Maybe. I think that is a good point. And I think that it goes along with, this is Rashi here talking about specifically that he remembered Vashti, says that he became sad and was remorseful, having realized that her refusal to appear before him was justified and the decree against her was wrong.
That's the Midrash.
That's the Midrash, yeah. So if you do that and draw a flood story comparison, right, it's kind of similar to God saying he's never going to do this again.
Right.
The difference being that in this story, we are going to see him
try and
do this again.
Yeah.
Well, you know, not necessarily with a new wife, but he is going to issue a decree to kill a bunch of people.
Oh, right. If you track with the further, I was thinking about God's faithfulness and that God remembers God's Vashti and sticks with them, right? He's like, oh, Noah, my one faithful guy. Okay, come on out. Let's cut a covenant versus... here, even if he remembers her and realizes what he did was bad, he still goes and finds a new top queen. And what a world it would be if God had picked some other animal. All done with humans, we're appointing the dogs. The dogs are now the carriers of God's blessing on the world. Maybe they are. Who am I to say?
Well, let's keep going then and see what else we can draw out of this.
Right. It says what had been cut over her. You left me a comment in our manuscript here pointing out, I think I had like decreed or something. And you're like, that's the word for cut. So George is over here keeping me honest, which I appreciate and enjoy. I think that might be related to cutting the parchment. We see this when they're sending out decrees. It's in my imagination, which could be totally wrong. It's like slicing off a sheaf of paper, of papyrus or whatever from the roll.
Okay.
And that's why it's cut.
Interesting.
But again, that's conjecture. I don't know why it's cut. And I totally get why everybody goes with decree, and I try to as well. But the young men of the king who attended to him said, it's also like a story about bad counsel.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And connected to youth, too. It's pointed right. out these are not just like his wise men or his magicians, if we were going to go Egypt, right?
These are his buddies, his counselors. Chums. Yeah.
These are the young guys specifically.
Yep.
Yeah. So different things that can inebriate you, actual alcohol, but also bad advice. And they say this thing that's almost hilarious if it's not a bummer. Let them seek out young women still separate from society, good and for looking at.
Right.
Not good for looking at, good and also for looking at.
Well, and you know, that's the Vashti situation, right? Her whole
right.
thing was simply about they wanted to look at her.
Right, right. On behalf of the king, I mean, I do love the difference that they draw there. Somebody could be good, but not for looking at. It's not just bad to look at equals bad. It's can be good to look at and bad, or vice versa. Anyway, still separated from society. We've talked about this way back, probably in like the Rivka story in Genesis. We talked about how the word that's usually translated virgin
right.
in English etymology comes from the word for young, like virgin snow or whatever. Well, I know that has to do with untouched. It comes from a root that has to do with the greenness and something that's fresh. In the Hebrew, it comes from this root that has to mean separated. It means they're still kept back. And I think way back then when we talked about it, I used the analogy of like the Regency era. She would not have had her debut yet, which makes sense. He's not going, well, it's kind of doesn't make sense, but it does in a frustrating way. Yeah, that he's not pulling from the marriage market that's already circulating, right? He's not pulling from the women who are currently you know, halfway
looking
through their
for
agreements,
marriage.
Right,
yeah.
And getting engaged and showing up at the festivals and doing all the things that they do. He's going for the ones that haven't been paraded around town yet, which is upsetting depending on how old that might have been, which I am not equipped at this moment to speculate about, possibly because it would make me sad, but also just because I haven't done the work yet. But so that's why that's translated that way. And on behalf of the king
right.
will appoint managers in all provinces of his kingdom. They will gather together all the young women who are still separated from society, blah, 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 to the fortress of Shushan, the house of the women. Here that is again. It seems like it's a separate house for the hand of Hege, Whispering Fire. It's a fun name. Who doesn't like that? The guardian of the women. They will be gifted to him for their scouring and polishing.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. There were, you know, we kind of talk about these different comparisons to other places in the text. To me, also, this story gives off Joseph vibes.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of different ways. But this part right here specifically, I think, has some more direct links to the Joseph stories in that the advice given is the king will appoint managers in all the provinces of his kingdom. They will gather together all the young women, etc. Right? That's what Joseph tells Pharaoh to do with the grain in order to avoid famine.
Right.
And it's using the same language, even the word for managers, the word for gathering. All come from that Genesis 41-ish section.
Right.
Well,
obliquely, both stories are about folks surviving in a land that's not their own, under
right.
the empire of another who is an oppressing agent in some way. And it has been postulated reasonably by some amongst us that... that they could even be concurrently written stories, as in the Yosef story was also written down during the time of
okay.
exile. of course, staying on brand for me, perceive a really big difference between the style and the vocabulary and the loan words in Esther versus those in the Yosef story, but that's fine. People, you know, I could write a story saying thou and thee. It would evoke an older writing style, so who knows? Who knows? I have an opinion, but that's not the end of the world. The young woman is good in the eyes of the king. Make her queen under Vashti.
That part's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a possibility that that under preposition means in place of, which is the way it's usually transmitted.
Right. Yeah.
And if I recall, there's other places in Tanakh where that has happened previously, where I've been like, that could be that. But literally, it's the under word, same as like they met under the mountain, right? Tachat.
Okay.
It's just under. What that makes me curious about is I grew up apparently with the rabbinic midrash. Though it wasn't presented that way, of course, that Vashti was hauled out back and done away with. And this makes me curious. We mentioned this last week, I believe, that maybe Vashti is just like retired.
Right.
And she just like lives out her days in the house of the women forever. But she's not the main queen anymore.
Right.
She's now the, you know, the previous wife and or the first wife, but not in a excited, like not in an honorable status, in a old hat status, and that Esther is just will be the new queen underneath her, but higher in status. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's an odd phrase, whichever way you look at it. So
yeah,
fascinating. So this thing was good in the eyes of the king. He did so.
Again, even just the phraseology in this narrative places this king is so simple.
Suggestible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like we've got a long paragraph from these bros who are like, hey, I've got an idea, blah, 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 blah. And then they don't even give the king the dignity of a line of like, thank you for bringing this to me. It is pleasing unto my eyes. You shall do it in my name. You know, we don't get that one of those dialogues. We just get, it was good. He did it. And I think that's a artistic ploy on purpose. But then the camera pans over.
Right.
From the palace in the fortress.
Yeah, it zooms out and there's this guy squatting behind the wall peering in.
Yeah. And he is presented as a man of Yehuda, which is an interesting first moniker. I don't know exactly what to make of that. Thinking
yeah,
about
it
who
is,
Judah is.
Right. It is unusual.
Judah is connected to another philandrous woman, right? Which I don't know that Esther is being philandrous, but a woman who's up to a lot.
Yeah. Rashi's going to say that this is just the common term for those brought into exile.
Right. Okay.
From
sure.
The kingdom of Judah.
Right.
So it's just, you know, when that happened, that's what they were referred to as by their captors.
Right. Right, right, right. Yes. When I was in school, my professors were pretty unified about not calling those people Jews.
Okay.
That came from Judean and that evolved much, much later. And so that's in line with what I was taught, though. I know that wouldn't be comfortable for... I mean, there's just room for conversation there, but that was what my professors taught me. And his name is Mordechai, which I find fascinating. His name...
Yeah, how did he get this name?
...is Marduk. Marduk is, of course, the god of the Babylonians, the god who got kidnapped by the Assyrians and given back later. And it was for that reason that the Babylonians would eventually overthrow the Assyrians and conquer them, cause the Neo-Assyrian Empire's downfall. But anyway, major deity. And whereas Esther is also the name of a major deity, right? Ishtar, Esther.
Right. We're given her...
her actual name first, her non-anglicized name, as it were. And we don't get that for Mordechai, which is really interesting to me. It's also interesting to me from a narrative perspective about why is he introduced as the first protagonist here? Because we have this like a great opener of some wild chaos, things that suck you in. You know, if this was an action movie, this would be the opening scene with, you know, a gaudy ball party going on, and you see the evil antagonist, and you see him have a little scene that introduces us to him. And then the inciting event occurs, which is Vashti's refusal. And then it would happen where you'd have the pan down, but you would expect that the name of the scroll is Esther, and we would expect it to indeed be Esther with, you know, maybe Mordechai is in the back room or whatever, or making her some rice, I don't know, in their home. And you would be introduced to them both at the same time or centering Esther, but not just, look, guys, you need to know about Mordechai.
Well, I mean, according to rabbinic tradition, right, he's the one who wrote this scroll.
Right.
Right? So he's like writing a little introduction for himself.
This is
all of these things happened. And then, from around the corner appeared our hero.
A stunningly handsome man.
Yes, the humble Mordechai.
Yes, his hair blowing in the wind.
A simple baker with the best rolls on Fifth Street.
Perhaps. I think also, I don't know, I think there's probably more people when you're in the season of exile, land occupation, etc. There's probably more people who empathize with the role of Mordechai or who had experience of that at the time of the original listeners of this story. There were probably people who were Esthers who had been swept up into the household of a Babylonian or later a Roman, right, who had to figure out like, oh, gosh, oops, I'm a tax collector now. How am I supposed to work this out in an Esther-like way? But far more people would probably empathize with and share experience with Mordechai of like, I am an important figure in some way in the role of somebody who's been swept up by Babylon or swept up by Rome. How am I supposed to love them well when I feel like they might be kind of betraying our people? What does it mean that I was entrusted over this person in some way? And now they're off doing that. And in the story, we see Mordechai playing with tension with Esther a lot about who tells who what to do what, but he still checks after her peace, right, is what it says here.
Right.
Okay, so his name means Marduk. Fascinating. I don't know what to make of that. Maybe he's assimilated somewhat, right? He's the one telling Esther not to tell anybody her lineage, so maybe he has just like put all his chips on assimilating and just staying secretly a follower of Yahweh. Who knows? It doesn't even say that he's into following God particularly.
Right. But it also gives his lineage, right? Right. So there's like this double narrative going on of don't tell people where you're from. Mm-hmm. Also, here's our lineage.
Right, right. But the scroll would presumably have course been read to people who would understand that lineage. He's not wandering around trumpeting, hello, I'm the son of Yair, son of Shimi, son of Kish, man of Yamini. Who knows? But that's, he enlightens heated snare setter, son of my right hand, which what a happy little grouping you've got going on there.
Yeah.
He had been stripped from Yerushalayim. This is a common verb used to talk about the exile. It's a word for uncovering and nakedness. So it involves shame and horror and violence.
It's the Noah word.
Hmm. Is it?
Yes. Oh. For when he lay in his tent uncovered.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hmm. Well, it's also, that's really interesting because it's, I associate complicity with Noah in that story, and I don't as much associate complicity with the exile, but of course the prophets do.
They said, if you don't do this, then here's what's going to happen. Yes. So choose what you want.
That's not good 2024 politics, George. I feel like, well, if you didn't want to be subjugated, maybe you should have followed God. Oh dear. Well, don't go back and tell them. The text does ascribe that to the antagonist, that it says, who was stripped by Nebuchadnezzar. So it doesn't say they stripped themselves through their false worship and neglecting of the alien, the orphan, the widow. It puts the onus on Nebuchadnezzar, whose name I just mispronounced, whose name means God of wisdom, watch over my heir, which, golly gee whiz, he does need the God of wisdom to watch over his heir, because he doesn't have a lot of wisdom going on.
Fascinating. According to the Midrash, according to the sages, Vashti is the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay.
Which puts an extra spin on Ahasuerus.
Right.
Kind of doing the switcheroo.
He was the one who burst in out of nowhere and married in. Everyone was like, okay, what else?
Yep, guess he's here now. And whoops, the heir to Nebuchadnezzar is gone, and it's just him left.
Bummer.
So, they definitely lean into that craftiness nature of him kind of moving into power.
Gotcha.
In an interesting way, which is also, there's kind of this narrative that they kind of go along through these chapters here of him trying to figure out what Esther's lineage is.
Oh, okay.
So there's this whole subtext that they have for this. Of all the things that we have going on here, some of that is him trying to get her to tell him where she's from. What's her lineage?
Him being Ahasuerus?
Yes.
Hmm.
And the truth is that
I just laughed because I just pictured like a guy at the bar being like, wow, like where are you from?
Yeah, like what?
And the woman being like, oh, I'm from here. No, like before that, like where are you from?
Right. They say that she is from the line of Shaul, first king of Israel. So,
well, he was quite the looker himself, according to the text. So
yeah,
it tracks.
Yeah. So perhaps, redemption of his family here.
Yeah.
She's
also doing some hurting herself.
Sure. But also just in this whole thing, right? So Mordecai's trying to keep that a secret intentionally. They say because if the king figures out that she has royal lineage, then he will marry her and not let her go.
But he does like make her the queen. So
it
doesn't
backfires.
That happen?
It doesn't work out. She's just too good looking.
Darn.
Yep. Nothing
Whoopsies.
You can do. Cinderella story.
Fascinating. Yeah. I mean, the text doesn't say why he's so set on her lineage not being figured out and what would happen in his mind if it was figured out. But except for the foresight that it would have been harder for her to argue for her people later.
Sure.
Then the camera pans over to Hadassah.
Right.
Myrtle tree. I thought it was fascinating. Myrtle tree there, I always just like, yeah, cool. Judah and Tamar. Tamar is the word for palm tree. Mordechai and Esther. Esther means myrtle tree. But myrtle tree comes from the word for footstool. And so I think there's a really fun subversive thing in there about, I'm going to say that the story is about a million things, but one of them seems to be about power, right? And how it gets wielded and who really has it and et cetera. And in this story, she's going to use wiles of all kinds in order to make the one who supposedly has the most power kind of the footstool of the situation.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think that's fun. But her name gets changed to Esther, which is relatable for people who have had their names changed as they come into a different land that speaks a different language. Maybe they opted into that. Maybe they didn't opt into it. But there are people like you in the Bible. Esther is related to Ishtar, Ishtar is massive goddess, not literally massive, but enormously prevalent, as most listeners of this podcast probably know. Mesopotamian deity of love, fertility, and war. Those things don't get separated into different gendered slots. Love, fertility, and war.
Okay.
And I think that also fits with Esther.
Keep all your eggs in one basket.
But in the story, Esther has some...
elements of those things?
Yeah, she has got some cunning going on, yeah, along with her love and other skills. But yeah, shouldn't be overlooked. The name that was chosen for her still also has destiny relevance to her.
We have this, you know, the young woman was beautiful in her lines and good for looking at.
And when's the last time we had someone beautiful in their lines, George?
Well, I think it's a fun jumbling of those instances because, right, we have Sarah, who is described by Abraham as saying, I know that you are a beautiful woman to see, right?
Okay,
and
the sea.
Therefore the Egyptians are going to take you.
Yep.
We have...
Rachel is beautiful in her lines.
Yep. And beautiful to be seen. So kind of mirroring that same imagery, mm-hmm, here that we see in the text.
And then...
Joseph.
Yosef. Yep. We're back. Another connection.
Hey, girl. Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting, those three figures focusing in more on Rachel and Yosef. Neither of them get what they want. You know, Rachel is like, oh, yeah, I'm going to marry Yaakov. JK, got to wait 14 years.
Right.
And there is this horrible family dynamic as part of that. And so just the lining up of those characters helps see the double-edged sword there. That is good lines. Okay, it was when, last thing in that paragraph, Mordechai took her for himself for a daughter. I've run into Jewish teaching before that, took her for himself, full stop. That take word is a marriage word. And so some folks in the Jewish community mostly have been curious about, like, what kind of interesting are we talking about here? It does say for a daughter, but what if that's like in great parentheses and it's more like as a concubine who you're supposed to take care of, you know,
right,
like you do take care of a daughter. So, maybe.
Rashi's going to comment on that, kind of saying exactly what you're saying. So he's going to comment on the, as a daughter, our rabbis explained, for a house, the word, meaning as a wife. So stating that it does not mean as a daughter because Esther was not his child. So going exactly with what you are saying, which does make the story more interesting, right? From, you know, the Abraham perspective, from the Isaac perspective, right? Doing that same thing of people are going to take our wives because they're so good looking. Mm. Let's come up with a plot to make sure that doesn't happen.
Sneaky snake.
Mordecai just doesn't have quite the same game.
Who knows? I hope he's just adopting her. That is my opinion. I just said I don't really have one, but I do hope that he's just taking her in to take care of her. Okay, it was when the word of the king and the decree was heeded that a great many young women were gathered toward the fortress of Shushan into the hand of Hegai. Esther was taken to the house of the king toward the hand of Hegai, the guardian of the women. The young woman was good in his eyes. She bore up his compassion before his face. He trembled to hurry her, scouring and polishing, and with her portion he gave her 7 young men to seat her, gifted from the house of the king. And he folded them into the good place in the house of the women.
Feels kind of chiastic to me.
Ooh.
To have, right, it stuck out to me with the line of
the young
bringing
woman.
Back, well, the young woman bringing back Hege, mm-hmm, right? These descriptions of him that we saw already earlier in the chapter. And looking at it too, verse 5 is the description of Mordecai. Verse 7 is the description of Esther.
Okay.
outside of those is this line about, you know, being good in the eyes of the king and Hege and
so it's verse 6.
Verse 6 is he had been stripped from Yerushalayim, flowing peace with the stripped ones who had been stripped from Yechonai.
Okay.
God will make firm, right? Yeah. So is the
exile is the spinning point,
the catalyst. Yeah.
I think that it's a parallelism in that we had the young men earlier, and now it says the young women.
Men.
Yeah. And now it says young women.
Right.
And we were set up to be like, ugh, the foolishness of youth that all these bros gathered around like they're at a frat. And we're like, hey, we have an idea. And then it says young women. And we're like, oh, man, how is Esther going to cope? Are we going to see a total mirroring of a bunch of foolishness? But instead, right after that suspense line, it says she bore up compassion before his face,
right?
So she engenders compassion for herself, and then it says he trembled to hurry her scouring and polishing, which you pointed out in the manuscript is taken from, it's an unusual word, it's taken from Yaakov saying, is my son Yosef indeed alive? And
right.
So I think Hege here is being a eunuch who is functioning as her missing father, right? Just like Yaakov is trembling over his missing son. She's connecting with this father figure through this eunuch hanging out. She gets 7 friends, which, what a gift.
Right.
I want 7 friends dropped off on my doorstep. Ta-da, here they are. And then we have this first instance that we already have talked about. Esther had not declared her people or her place of birth, for Mordechai commanded over her that she not. All
right.
Day and every day, he walked himself before the face of the court of the house of the woman to learn of her peace and what was being done in her. So I've got like practical logistical questions. Like, what is his job? How does nobody be like, hey, dude, stop hanging out around the house of the women, you weirdo.
Right. What are you doing chilling outside the gate here?
Right.
Yeah.
All day, every day. Dang. Get a job. Come on. So I'm curious about logistics. But when I put on my, you know, ministry hat and think about what the scroll might be trying to say to people who find themselves as Mordechai's in exile, I think it's saying don't spend your time judging Esther. The Esther's around you, spend your time watching over them and trying to make sure that they're okay in their context, which might be dubious.
Right. We don't get a lot of background from the sages, from the Midrash, on Mordecai's job. but they do say that her 7 maidservants is what she used to track when Shabbat was going to be. Because she named each of them after the day of the week. And they would all serve her in turn. So when the one named Shabbat came, she would know it was the day of rest.
Wow. I don't know why it's so hard to count to 7 in some other way, but okay. It's that like coming, maybe that's coming from them not knowing what you would even do with 7 servants. And so therefore it must be 1 for each day of the week.
Yeah, 1 for each day of the week, so that the maidservants for weekdays would not observe her resting on Shabbat and know that she was Jewish.
Oh.
So.
Sneaky, once again.
Yep.
Got to keep it on the DL. Okay. So when each young woman's turn struck to enter toward the king Ahasuerus, which I love, it's so palpable, you know, when your turn struck. It's
right.
Exciting.
Yeah.
At the end, the boundary time of her regulations on the woman, 12 months, for so the days were filled with scouring and polishing. That's the real test, is if you can stay sane doing a spa day every single day for a year.
Yeah, I was reading the scouring and polishing is
word.
the word used in Leviticus for purifying a copper vessel. It has to be scoured and polished. It's part of the purification process.
Okay.
And that's definitely what this process is about, right? It kind of says it pretty literally in the text. It's kind of a...
you have to be made pure enough to come before the king. And it takes a year instead of a day.
Right.
Bummer. Oh boy, that reminds me of the Egyptians calling the Israel or the sons of Jacob abominations, right? They won't eat with them because they're gross. Maybe if they had had a whole year of exfoliation, then they would have gotten through.
Sure.
Okay, so I love the coyness of the narrator in that it doesn't say exactly what happened. It just says, in the dusk she went, and in the morning she returned to the house of the women into the hand of a new eunuch, which I think is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
So before we've got Whispering Fire guy, but when you come back, you're given over to Shaaskaz, which is a servant of the beautiful, which makes sense, like, now that you've properly been beautified for a year.
Right.
You're now with this guy and plenty of women, it seems like, never went back to the king because he has to call her by name, which honestly might not be the worst deal in the world. If you get to live in a palace your entire life and you only have to put up
with this guy once.
The king once, it's like, yeah, cool. Hang out with a bunch of other women all day. It's good. Good times. But when the turn struck for Esther, daughter of Avichail, uncle of Mordechai. So before it said that she didn't have a mother or a father. And now it says that the name of one of her parents, at least. And that's great so that we can't have any weird Star Wars Episode One midichlorian midrash.
Right. I am confused by, like, how is she the daughter of Avichail, uncle of Mordechai? Is that a different Mordechai?
I don't think so.
But Mordechai is also her uncle. So how is her father Mordechai's uncle, and then Mordechai is her uncle?
It's late at night. I can't envision the lines, but that's probably on Wikipedia. I'll probably tell you.
Something to figure out.
I think that means cousins, but I don't know. To come to the king, she sought nothing but what Haggai, the eunuch of the king, guardian of the woman, said, which is always a good call to defer to the person whose job it is to do these things. Esther bore up patronage in the eyes of all that looked at her. Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal house in the 10th month, that is, in Tevet, the 7th year of his reign.
Yeah. Another Noah word there to bring up the patronage.
Right.
Noah found patronage in the eyes of Yahweh.
Right.
So, hint, hint, wink, wink.
Right. Good stuff. The king loved Esther more than all the women. That is nice. I'm glad it's not just like the king looked at Esther and agreed, this one's good.
Right.
I'm into these lines. But no, he loved her, whatever that looked like for him. She bore up patronage and compassion before his face more than all the separated women. He placed his royal crown in her head and made her queen under Vashti. He made a great drinking party. We're back. Party
yep, we're
on.
Looping all the way back around, right?
Right, for all of his commanders and his servants. Equal opportunity, king. The drinking party of Esther and a day of rest in the provinces he had made. He gave lifted things according to the hand of the king. Doesn't say who the he is there, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
But I presume it's the king. He's giving gifts to people. The separated women were gathered together a second time, and Mordechai, like the creeper he is, continues to sit in the gate of the king.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Rashi's going to say that, you know, when he does this day of rest in the provinces, that what he's doing is he's waiving all of the taxes that would normally be collected.
Okay.
In her honor, he released them from the tax that was levied upon him because he still didn't know Esther's ancestry. They're looping right. It back into that. And Ahasuerus tried to draw the secret from her. He waived the taxes of all the provinces, and she still did not tell him. So it's kind of like him saying, I'm going to lift some taxes from people. What province do you want me to do it from? Maybe your hometown, you think? Like, where are you from? Maybe we can just, you know, eliminate some taxes from there and right. Help your people out. So making that kind of a you know, plot to figure out her lineage.
That's fun. I can imagine it. Esther had not declared her birth and her people as Mordechai had commanded over her. That's probably chiastic because we were reminded of that earlier. For Esther did the utterance of Mordechai as when she was in his trust. I went with utterance there because the typical word that you see when somebody receives a word or a commandment is the word. dvar. Which is also our word for speak. Yeah. And it's usually has this heightened, it's an intensive form word when somebody gives somebody something that they're supposed to hold on to and not deviate from. But Mordechai doesn't get that word. He gets the word for just saying something. So I don't know if that's supposed to make Esther look more noble, that it doesn't even have to be like the word of Mordechai for
kind
her to do it.
Kind of passively suggested it and could, she's taking that and using it.
Right. It could be that, or it could be saying something negative about Mordechai, but I think
what if
it's
we
probably
didn't tell him where you're from.
Yeah, right. I think it's probably the former. So Mordechai sitting in the gate of the king, which again, even though it's fun and comedic for me to imagine that he's being a weirdo, again, I believe the scroll is instructing people in this situation to not give up on people who have assimilated more than they have. So Mordechai sits in the gate of the king, Bigtan, in the wine press, keeping that motif going, and Teresh, austere, two of the eunuchs and guardians of the threshold, broke into a rage. I think it's fun that those are the names that they put in the wine press guy together with the austere guy, because it's showing that both sensibilities can be equally bent into disaster, you know, bent out of shape. It's not just like two party guys. It's one party guy and one person who's like, oh, I'm above all of that because his name is austere. But and yet it's both of them that broke into a rage. Two eunuchs. Which, by the way, if you're like, what did they hope for? They're just eunuchs. We've got eunuch kings in these empires. It happens sometimes. So,
okay. Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about the word for threshold because it seems to be a word that has multiple uses that can be a bit, I don't know,
they
confusing.
Look diverse.
Yeah.
They're not actually. If you have the one key.
The
understand.
One key. But this is the word I'm going to, the first mention that we have of this is going to be Exodus chapter 12, the Exodus chapter. It's going to be the, you will take a bunch of oregano, dip it in the blood that is in the bowl, the threshold, the bowl, who knows?
Right.
One or the other.
What's the combination between threshold and bowl and basin?
They have ridges.
Yes.
They have a lip.
Very good. Very, very good, George. The threshold is the lip of the house.
Bowl.
No, of the house. And the house is the bowl. So that's the combo breaker. They're not guardians of the basin or the bowl, though that's imaginable. I don't think that's the case in here because Mordechai is sitting in the gate. It'd be weird if the cup of the king was also in the gate.
I mean, it would help for the Joseph line up, right? Because you got the baker and the wine guy, and one of them does get killed at the end.
Okay. They're in a prison. They're in a prison hole, if you recall, but sure.
No credit given.
We're almost there. We're almost at the end. They sought to send a hand in the king Ahasuerus. That's a very literal. Everybody else goes with against send. If they go that literal at all, they go with send a hand against King Ahasuerus.
Okay.
Which certainly makes more sense in the English. It's just not the preposition against. And I left it as literal as it is because that tends to be the side of the pattern I usually fall on anyway. Let folks wrestle on their own. But I wonder if the in rather than against has to do with like the inner landscape of the king. They sought to send a hand in the king of Cheshverush? Like they're trying to get in his business and stir things up. Not necessarily that they're going to commit murder or a coup or whatever, but that they're sending a hand to tweak something with the king that would affect his inner
it's
world.
It's a plot. Yes. It is mirrored with the top of the chapter, right? We have the hand of Hege, who is also a eunuch at the very top.
Yeah.
Who is orchestrating, you know, previously this whole setup with the brides to be.
Right.
It could be they're trying to replace Hege or something, and this is a plot to do that, or, you know, some other thing with the king. I like that. I think it's interesting. But it's going to say that this thing became known to Mordecai. They're not going to say how, other than he declared it to Esther.
Yeah. Big cinematic loss, Spirit of God. Come on. Being facetious. But I want to know, like, was he sneaking around the corner and listening in on convos and gathering intel?
Yeah.
Or is everybody talking about it the next day because the two eunuchs were super drunk when they were talking about this?
Right.
I'm curious.
Rashi is going to say that the matter was apprehended by Mordecai, for they were discussing their affairs before him in the Tarshian language, and they did not know that Mordecai was familiar with 70 languages.
Oh, wow.
Because he was one of the Sanhedrin.
Oh.
And therefore had to know 70 languages in order to understand and hear direct testimony without a translator in the court of the Sanhedrin. So.
What a polyglot. 70. I know. Okay.
Which, again, Joseph vibes, because that's part of how they say Joseph got into power with the king, is because he knew 70 languages.
Right. Apparently, that's just the bar. So everybody who's like reading your Bible every day,
right,
doing your best.
New goal.
Actually, you're way behind. You need 70 languages. Big bummer. I've got a long way to go. Okay, so he tells the queen, I have even more questions. How does he get word to the queen?
Yeah, later, how does that work?
Yeah, later when they're going to go back and forth, it says like somebody brought a note and tells the story of that. But here he's just like, hey, while she's on her morning
good
walk.
Good question.
And then Esther credits Mordechai, which is quite an interesting move, you know, very charitable of her. The thing was sought out. It was found. What a relief, by the way. Can you imagine? I'd be so nervous if I was Mordecai. Okay, the king's like sending out people to find out, and nothing will come of it, and I'll lose all access and credibility and maybe get killed myself. The two of them were hung upon a tree. I love that ambiguity. Again, I think that's a narrator being like, wait, is it Mordecai and Esther being hung?
We don't know who it is yet.
Right, but then chapter 3 happens, and you're like, oh, okay. It was written in the scroll of the words of the days before the face of the king. All important foreshadowing for later. Well, I'll come back.
I'm excited to get into it.
Yep. If you have thoughts, ideas, questions, comments, encouragements, exhortations, send them to textandus@gmail.com.
So spirited.
It's late at night.
This has been the Text in Us podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope that you will join us again for Esther chapter 3.